I've heard you lead that song once before, but that's a new song to me. It's a beautiful song. Beautiful song. There are three world religions that claim to believe in Jehovah God: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And from a comparative religion standpoint, these are the only monotheistic religions, the only religions that believe in one God. Other world religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, etc., either recognize some impersonal force or they are polytheistic, meaning they have plural gods. We're looking at Islam. If you weren't here last week and didn't get a sheet with some definitions on it and would like it, there are some on your way out in the foyer there on the far side that you're welcome to pick some up. I try not to preach a lot of lessons that are just for information. I really believe that a sermon needs to have a personal application to our lives, something that we can incorporate into our lives. But I suppose that these two lessons, last Sunday night and this lesson, are pretty much informative. I think it's something that we probably as Christians need to be able to speak at least with some knowledge on this topic of Islam, because it has become such a major force in our world today. Comparing the basis of authority of each one, Judaism recognizes the Old Testament as being inspired. Christianity recognizes the Bible, both the Old and New Testament, as inspired. Islam recognizes the Bible and the Quran as inspired. And I will have some qualifications of their acceptance and recognition of the Bible as being inspired, but they do claim to accept the Bible and the Quran both as being inspired. And so tonight I would like to examine some of the doctrines and practices and beliefs of Islam. Obviously, that's a pretty deep well and will only touch the hem of the garment, but at least a few things that I think would be pertinent in any discussion that you might find yourself in. And so to enable you to have some more understanding about Islam and the Muslim religion. About the Quran and the Bible, and we could spend two or three lessons on each one of these topics, but I've just picked out a few things that I suppose I picked them out because they're interesting to me and I think meaningful. There are, in the Quran, numerous contradictions. Most students of Islam will explain it as a division between Muhammad's days in Medina and his days in Mecca. And there were things that he wrote in the early part of his life that he wrote something exactly the opposite in the latter part of his life. And you can go online and find almost probably all of this material, some of the contradictions there, but they have solved that in their own mind by claiming that this was when he was in Mecca and this was when he was in Medina. While claiming to believe that the Bible is inspired, and the Quran itself claims that the Bible is inspired in Surah 10, 38 and 39, and I'll give you some of these references in the Quran. If you would care to write them down, or if you would like to have a copy of my notes, I'll be glad to share that with you as well. And when you say surah, that is the word for chapter, or what we would call a chapter or a division of the Quran. And it has 114 different divisions of it, or chapters. And in chapter 10, verse 38 and 39, it claims that the Bible is inspired. It also, in Surah 19, claims that the New Testament specifically is inspired. Both the writers of the Old Testament and the New Testament, it claims to be inspired in Surah 21:7. And it states that Muslims must believe the Bible in Surah 29, 46, and 47. And in reality, most Muslims do not believe the Bible. Like some other religious groups that we're familiar with, they believe the Bible is insufficient, it's flawed, and inaccurate. But all the while, when they come to your door and knock on your door, they will say, I believe the Bible is inspired just like you do. But when, in fact, you begin to discuss with them, you find out that they believe the Bible is filled with inaccuracies and that it was incomplete. And, of course, since Muhammad lived some 600-plus years after the Old Testament, then we have some, 600-and-something years after Jesus, excuse me, then they had the Old Testament to use as a springboard. And they believe in reality that this was a continual progression of revelation, and the Old Testament was revealed, the New Testament was revealed, and the Quran was revealed, and the Quran is the most complete revelation from God. All the statements that either in the Bible that either contradict Islamic teaching or teach that Jesus is divine are said to be corruptions of the Bible, that they were not that way originally, that it was changed since its original writing. They deny that Jesus Christ was born of a virgin. They deny that Jesus died and was resurrected, that he died on a cross. They say that God actually took him up to heaven, that he was a prophet, and God took him up to heaven. And a quote from chapter 4, or Surah 4, 156 through 159, they did not kill him, speaking of Jesus, nor crucify him, but so it was made to appear. And so they said it was people were duped, and he was not really crucified on a cross. They claimed that Jesus was created from dust like Adam was in Surah 3, 59. Interestingly, Muhammad in the Quran encouraged Muslims to verify his teaching by consulting Jews and Christians. And he said in Surah 10, 94, who, speaking of Jews and Christians, who have been reading the book before thee, speaking to his followers. And the book would refer to the Bible. Muhammad regularly referred to Jews and Christians as people of the book and admired them and respected them for having a book of law, as he perceived it. They believed the Quran existed eternally with Allah in heaven, that it was never created, but it was always in God's mind, and every revelation was just a progressive revelation to the point of the Quran. And so that's something about a comparison between the Quran and the Bible. Now, a little bit about the basic fundamental beliefs and practices of Islam. It is based, as many of you know, on five pillars. These are obligatory practices followed by all Muslims that they're required to make a part of their life. The first pillar is the profession of the Shahada. And the word Shahada means a witness or testimony, and that is literally what you hear Muslims recite. It is a declaration of the oneness of God and the acceptance of Muhammad as his prophet. And if you, in sincerity, recite that prayer, then that simply makes you a Muslim. That's what it takes to become a Muslim, is that you sincerely recite the Shahada. And it translates into English, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of God. That's the Shahada. And that's the means by which a believer becomes a Muslim. The second pillar is prayer. And we noted last time that at the very beginning of the Muslim religion, Islam, then Muhammad was supposedly taken up into the seventh heaven. Moses was his tour guide. They talked to God. God commanded Muslims to pray 50 times a day. And Moses explained to God that that was not a reasonable expectation of people, and so he worked it down to five. And so one of the second pillar of Islam is prayer. Five times each day, At daybreak, at noon, at mid-afternoon, at sunset, and evening, Muslims are called to prayer. And you can check with Bob and Monica about this after they lived there for some period of time, slightly before daylight, then this call to prayer, and everybody was awakened, and all the Muslims came out to pray. Others of you have been to some of the countries where this also takes place. Prayer is preceded by washings to cleanse the hands, the mouth, the face, and the feet. And each prayer consists of between 2 and 4 prostrations, where you get down on your knees and lay flat and put your face to the earth. Depending on the time of day, it's either 2 or 4, always facing Mecca. Friday noon prayer is a special congregational prayer, preferably at the central mosque in each community. Prayer is comprised of memorized sections, recitations, including the Shahada that we just mentioned. The third pillar is almsgiving. All adult Muslims are required, and since its first writing, it has been qualified somewhat to say those whose income is above a certain minimum amount, all adult Muslims are required to pay 2.5% of their total assets annually. I did not say 2.5% of their annual income. I said 2.5% of their total assets annually. And so lots of money comes into their coffers. It's used to support the poor, orphans, widows, free slaves, debtors, and to assist in the spread of Islam. Today, in some Islamic countries, the payment is left to the individual, and you're left to your own to do that. However, recently, some governments, including Pakistan, the Sudan, and Libya, collected as a state tax, and so they require it. The fourth pillar is the fast of Ramadan, which, by the way, we're into that Ramadan month at this time. I think last Sunday or Monday was the first part of Ramadan, so we're right in the middle of that. It's a Muslim holiday. Up until a few years ago, very few people in the United States heard anything about it, and now most companies are required to honor it in the same way that they would, or not honor it in the same way they would certain, quote, Christian holidays. And so we're becoming more familiar with Ramadan. During the 9th month of the Muslim month, all adult Muslims are to abstain from food, drink, and sexual activity from dawn until sunset. And the purpose is to express gratitude to God, and catch the second one, to atone for sins. Remember what we talked about this morning about living under law? To atone for sins, to acknowledge their dependence on God, and to respond to the needs of the poor. It ends at the end of the month with a feast of the break of the fast, at which time families come together for a 3-day feast and they exchange gifts, and that will mark the end of Ramadan. The fifth pillar is the pilgrimage or the Hajj. Every adult Muslim who can afford it has been added now, is expected to make this pilgrimage to Mecca at least one time during his lifetime. The focus of the pilgrimage is the Kaaba, the square building which houses the sacred black stone. Muslims believe that Abraham and his son Ishmael built the original Kaaba on the foundation laid by Adam himself. They believe the stone was given to Abraham by the angel Gabriel as a symbol of Allah's covenant with the Muslims. And so it is a holy stone, and it is a holy building that houses it. There are numerous rituals and ceremonies which they perform as a part of the pilgrimage, among which is they want to go to the spot that has been designated as the spot where Abraham was believed to have stood and offer prayer on that very spot. They practice a ritual of the stoning of Satan, who is represented by 3 pillars. They also have a practice of running back and forth across the valley to commemorate Hagar's frantic search for water for her son Ishmael. You remember after Abraham had cast them out and she went a stone's throw away and her son, she thought, was going to die, and an angel appeared to her. So they run back and forth to commemorate a frantic search for water. And then there are numerous other rituals. That's just some of them. And to take this pilgrimage greatly increases the prospects of your salvation. And then there is the jihad, which we're all maybe more familiar with, or at least we've heard a lot about. And the word jihad simply means struggle. It is the word, and the concept of jihad is interpreted both literally and metaphorically. And so it's a little bit hard to pin somebody down, because when to one Muslim they will say it means one thing, and to another it means something else. Sometimes it's referred to as the sixth pillar of Islam, though it is not officially recognized as such. The term jihad is used in the Quran in three different ways. In Surah 29, 68, and 69, it is used to denote a struggle for personal purity. And so it's a jihad, to purify your own nature. And then in Surah 25, 51, and 52, it is an intellectual struggle against an unbeliever. And so it would include such things as writing and debating and so forth. So an intellectual struggle. And then there is the literal warfare. And this, the most common usage of the term in the Quran, is aggressively downplayed by Muslims who live in non-Muslim countries today. And they'll say, well, that never really was the intent of it. It's this struggle that we have individually, or it is a metaphorical struggle. Evangelistic activities by Christians is considered an official act of aggression against Muslims and Islam, and is punishable by death in places where it is enforced. And because of the UN and certain other pressures that have been brought to bear on some countries today, then there are countries that even 5 years ago practiced putting someone to death who don't practice that anymore. But there are still places where people who are Christians are being killed for being Christians, and they're certainly being persecuted. Let me give you some quotes from the Quran that would deal with this relationship to people who would try to convert someone from Islam. In Surah 2, 190 and 191, fight in the cause of Allah. Those who fight you, slay them wherever you catch them. Such is the reward of those who suppress faith. In Surah 2, 216 and 217, fighting is prescribed for you, and you dislike it. But it is possible that ye dislike a thing which is good for you. And if any of you turn back from their faith and die in unbelief, their works will bear no fruit in this life and in the hereafter. They will be companions in the fire and will abide therein. Now, if you didn't put all that together, he says, if you don't fight, then you're going to burn. You're not going to heaven. Quran promises heaven for those who fight in the cause of Allah. In Surah 4, 74 through 76, let those fight in the cause of Allah who sell the life of this world for the hereafter. To him who fighteth in the cause of Allah, whether he is slain or gets victory, soon shall we give him a reward of great value. Those who fight or who believe fight in the cause of God, and those who reject faith fight in the cause of evil. So fight ye against the friends of Satan. Again in Surah 4, verses 4 through 6, therefore when you meet unbelievers, smite at their necks. At length when you have thoroughly subdued them, bind a bond firmly upon them. But those who are slain in the way of God, he will never let their deeds be lost. Soon he will guide them and improve their condition and admit them to the garden which he has announced for them. And those are quotations, again, from the Quran. Just a little observation and note. Heaven for the Muslims is a place where he'll be reclining on green couches in rooms of fine carpet, eating meals of delicious fruit, drinking exquisite wines, and being waited on, and I changed that just a little bit, with virgins with large, beautiful eyes. And it is, you can read that in Surah 78. And we've heard a lot about, I guess, I don't know what word to say, maybe kind of a put down about the 72 virgins. Actually, that is not in the Quran. It is, however, an Islamic tradition that every man who makes it, and particularly those who die in fighting, will receive 72 virgins. And it's given in pretty exquisite detail about a man who has these women, and it will be, he'll have a canopy over him that is made out of a single pearl, and it is 60 miles from one side of it to the other, and the virgins will be put in designated places all the way around this canopy, and one of them will not even ever meet the other one and so forth, so he can just make the rounds as he sees fit. Some additional teachings about judgment in Surah 100. And again, the reason I put these in is because we've done some teaching and some studying about law and trying to be judged by law. In Surah 100, it talks about a man's deeds will be weighed on balance scales. If his good deeds are heavy, he'll go to paradise. If his good deeds are light, he will go to eternal fire. There is no redemption. There is no payment for sins except your own, as we talked about in Ramadan. The concept of grace is totally foreign to Islam. There is no place for grace in the law system. Some interesting notes about women. You've heard things about that. In a civil trial, the testimony of one man is equal to the testimony of two women. A man may punish his wife by beating her in Surah 4:34. There's been a lot of concern about that, and that has been called into question publicly, and their response is that that's talking about just lightly tapping somebody. Women may have half the inheritance rights of men. A man may marry up to four wives. In Surah 4:3, a woman is not allowed outside her home unless she is accompanied by a male relative. Marriage is compulsory unless you are financially or physically unable. A Muslim man can marry a Jew or a Christian, but a woman cannot marry a non-Muslim. A man can divorce his wife by simply saying, "I divorce you." A woman may must obtain a divorce through the court system in Surah 65:1, and she is required to show just cause. The mandatory veils and clothing that cover the entire body of the women is not required by the Quran, but it is imposed sometime before the 13th century, and a tradition carried on to this day. Stealing, and they are extremely harsh on any violation of law. Stealing is punishable by the amputation of the hands. Surah 5:38. Islam is a religion that is extremely legalistic and therefore, consequently, extremely harsh, because that's what legalism does to you. It makes you harsh. The Arab society in our day, in recent times, has become ripe for unrest. More than 50% of the population of almost every Arab country is currently below 25 years of age. Now let that sink in some, and what that means for the future. The phenomenal wealth that has come to these countries through oil revenues has contributed to that unrest. The resentment of the Western world, and particularly the United States, for intervening in the politics of Arab countries, namely the defense of Israel's efforts to establish a homeland at the expense, as they perceive it, of the Palestinians, and also U.S. troops that are stationed in the Gulf region. recent years has seen inroads made into Western society by Muslim activists. And sometime, if you want, we can talk about the black Muslims, which actually is not Muslim. The Muslims will not claim that movement, but the black Muslims claim Muslim movement, but something completely different than the Muslims that we're discussing in Islam. According to Abdullah Al-Arabi, who is a writer for Islam Review Online currently, I quote, "In an effort to become acceptable to the Western mind, some Muslim activists have decided that, quote, since they could no longer use the sword to conquer the world as they once did, they decided to use more cunning methods, such as changing their identity, their vocabulary, and their political strategy." Now, you could get quotes like that all day long, and if you look it up online, then certainly you can. The goal of Islam has been, and I guess I will say, continues to be, world domination. Islam is a religion and a government. They're not separated. We are really into this thing about separation of church and state. They don't have that struggle. There is no separation. They're one and the same. Therefore, both democracy and Christianity come in direct confrontation to Islam, and they despise both. The Quran teaches that any Muslim who converts to another faith must be killed. Now, there are countries that have made some pretty violent turns in the last even months, but certainly last couple of years, are India. And if you know anybody that works in India, 5 years ago, there was very little difficulty. Today, that difficulty is increasing and has become an extremely dangerous place to proselyte and to teach. Pakistan, Iraq, Egypt, and Nigeria. And Nigeria is a really, really tough place right now where Americans and Christians are encouraged to not travel. We could talk lots more about it. Again, I'm going to come back to the point and say, we don't want to live, we don't want to be judged by law for our salvation. We want to live where there is law. Law is not the problem. It's misusing law as a standard of judgment for salvation. There's the problem. And we talked this morning about the curse of being under law. You have to keep it perfectly. You have to keep it perfectly all the time without a single mistake. And when you live with some form of that, and obviously you're going to have to soften that up some over the years, but when you live with some form of that, it affects your life. It affects your attitude. It affects your relationship with one another. It affects homes. It affects businesses. It affects everything. And affects it in a really harsh way. Christianity makes people kinder and gentler. I'm glad to be a Christian. I don't want to be condescending about other religions. But Jesus said, there is no other way to heaven. I am the door. Any man that would come in, seek to come in any other way, the same as a thief and a robber. There is no other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. Jesus Christ. We cannot back down from teaching the truth. Even when and if it becomes unpopular, and even when and if it becomes dangerous. We have no choice. We do it in love. We do not do it with pride. We do not have any arrogance. We do it in love. We're sinners saved by God's grace. And everybody else in the world is in the same boat. And God is not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And so, as Jesus teaches us to deal with our those who would consider us enemies, our enemies. Pray for them. Do good for them. Teach them. Love them. And we need to practice that in our lives. Because that's the only thing that's really going to change hearts. And hearts have to be changed one at a time. So I hope that there is something that's been said in these lessons that will be beneficial. I don't want to continue on with more minutia. But you're welcome to have the notes that I have or anything that I can have that will help you. And if you have a neighbor that is a Muslim, then I hope that this will help you, give you some basis for discussion and understanding where they're coming from so that you can talk to them about Jesus. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, or if as a Christian you've not been living the way that you know God wants you to, He gives us an opportunity to come to Him while we stand and sing.